Hello, and welcome to the Expanding Eyes podcast. We have been examining some of the complexities of a very complex play, and yet one of Shakespeare's greatest plays, greatest comedies, Twelfth Night, one of the so-called festive comedies, as indicated by the very title, Twelfth Night, the Twelfth Night of the 12 Days of Christmas. In tradition, a day of revelry and merrymaking, and of letting down the normal social rules. The theme of the overturn, temporarily, of the normal order is one of the running themes of the play. And there are many of them, many strands of thematic imagery that we have to hold in our heads until finally, by the end, we hope that we can get a sense of how they all fit together into a common pattern, all of which is, in one way, explanation for, if not apology for, the amount of plot recapping that I've been doing every week at the beginning of each new podcast episode, mindful of the fact that it is very complicated. Shakespeare, by this point in his career, had reached the full maturity, and the patterns are so rich that you really have to go to a good amount of effort to keep up with the richness of it all. And also, of course, the week's gap between podcast episodes, so that we are all mindful of the possibility of forgetting some of what we knew a week ago. With that in mind, let's return to Act 3, Scene 4, the last scene in the central act, and a very long one, in which both of the double plots start reaching some sort of crescendo or coming to a head. Just about every Shakespearean comedy has two plots that run simultaneously and bounce off of each other in a contrapuntal sort of way. There is usually an upper level plot of the upper level characters, usually involving some sort of romantic love dilemma, and we have that here, though with some particular twists of gender disguise and gender bending in that plot. And then a lower level plot that is normally a satiric plot making fun of the lower social class, nevertheless intersecting with the upper level plot at certain points. Here, because one of the central themes of the play is the overturn of all norms, all normal order, one of the indications of that in Twelfth Night is the fact that the satiric subplot is actually fomented by upper-level characters who are acting out of normal character. This is the crowd clustered around the leadership, if that's what we're going to call it, of Sir Toby Belch. His cohorts, Sir Andrew Aguecheek, Maria, who is in fact well-born and a gentlewoman and not just a servant, and Fabian. These are a carousing, revelry-making crew who, if it were in real life, we might find something of an annoyance because they would be the ones out in the yard at 3 a.m. singing drunken songs night after night. And we might have some sympathy with the attempts of the figure whose job it is to maintain order in the household to crack down on them a bit, except that in the household we're in, which is the household of Olivia, here, the order figure is Olivia's steward, Malvolio, and we don't like order when it is imposed by a coercive, heavy-handed, authoritarian type who we begin to think clearly likes order, not so much because order is a good thing in any functional society, but because there is a control freak thing going on in this person psychologically. And that would be Malvolio, the humorous, puritanical. We use that word as an adjective these days with little to no reference to actual Puritans. And there is a reference in the play making clear that Shakespeare does not want to identify Malvolio as an actual religious Puritan, even though religion does make its way into the fabric of the play in one way or another. But he's not a Puritan in the sort of theological sense at all. He is, in the popular sense, puritanical. Anything that is fun, he's against it. It must be bad. He wants to crack down on it. He is the figure in this play of a type that Northrop Frye called the refuser of festivity. All comedies have a mood of festivity. It's what we call the comic mood. And there is a character who represents the opposite of that and who becomes an obstacle figure. And Frye deems it a type, the refuser of festivity. It is an obstructive character that is as close as comedy comes to an actual villain. Some of the refusers come closer than others. Don John the Bastard in Much Ado About Nothing crosses the line between jerk and outright villain, and yet does so in a sort of scarecrow, pathetic sort of way. He is not nearly what, say, Iago is in Othello. Usually they are figures that are more ridiculous than imposing, and yet they want to crack down, partly for psychological reasons, perhaps. But Maria shrewdly observes at a passage that we noted in a previous week, she has sized Malvolio up and recognizes that in this particular case, there is not so much some sort of conviction. Malvolio is a hypocrite. His name means ill will, Malvolio, and he is indeed dour and censorious, but it's all a facade. He is a social climber. And there is a social class moment to this because Malvolio is not as well-born as the people he's trying to crack down upon. And it's one reason that he has difficulty imposing his authority. He is of a lower class, the middle class, and the Puritans were, in real-life history, they were the rising middle class. And they were censorious. It was the Puritans that drove the theaters outside the city limits of London, to the other side of the Thames, outside of the reach of the law, because the Puritans usually controlled the city law. And they did not approve of stage plays and much else that went on across the Thames, which included sports like bear baiting, something that is repeatedly mentioned in the imagery of the play. The chaining of a bear to a stake and then the tormenting of the animal. And this was regarded as good fun by some people. Duke Orsino's name means bear. And there are references to the baiting of a bear, and Malvolio within the scene we're looking at will be baited as if he were a kind of a bear in a way that either verges on or crosses the line into, for us, not really being quite funny anymore. We shall see. But at any rate, Malvolio is a hypocrite. He does not have religious convictions. He does not really have moral convictions. He does not even have a psychological need for order. He is a climber. And he is currying favor with Olivia. And in a soliloquy that he is stupid enough to blurt out on the street where Sir Toby and his crew can hear it, he fully admits that the ultimate would be to marry Olivia, not because he has the slightest love for her, but because this would put him in the position of ultimate power. So Sir Toby's crew immediately has it in for him, and they are hatching a plot, and we saw that last week. They leave an anonymous letter signed only with the initials M-O-A-I, which Malvolio somehow or other contortedly twists to think that's a reference to his name because, gee, it has all the right letters, you know, all those letters are in my name, so it must be referring to me. And it says, I am madly in love with you, without naming. M-O-A-I says, madly in love with you, and oh, how I wish you would come in and really let yourself be yourself. Come in and be arrogant with everybody else, especially the other people in the court, and come in wearing yellow stockings, cross-gartered, which all we need to know about this is that this is a fashion faux pas of grotesque proportions. He is going to look like a complete idiot. And to smile. You know how I love you to smile. Malvolio has never smiled before this in his life. He does not know how to do it, and on him it's going to look like the grin of a skull. It will be absurdly not only out of character, like what, but look very forced to the point of grotesque. He swallows all of this, and in scene four of the central act, what we've been waiting for happens. He comes on stage and enacts this. He enters the court. Olivia is warned. Where is Malvolio? Well, he's coming, madam, but in very strange manner. He is sure possessed, madam. Does he rave? Well, yeah. And he comes in. Sweet lady, ho ho. Olivia says, smilest thou? I sent for thee upon a sad occasion. And he continues to put his foot in it and to say things that Olivia and everyone else can only take as, at least everybody else who's not in on the joke, take as complete raving, to the point of, do you have a fever? Are you delirious? Are you well? And Olivia then innocently says, because of that, wilt thou go to bed, Malvolio? Meaning, you're not yourself. Maybe you should go to bed and sleep it off. And of course, Malvolio takes that. To bed, aye, sweetheart, and I'll come to thee. And, oh my God, Olivia, after a continued interchange, says in line 58, why, this is very midsummer madness. Here we're back to the festive theme, but with an ambiguity that I'm not totally sure I can account for, but let me throw out a tentative explanation. Midsummer madness. And as this scene goes on, in line 144, Fabian says, more matter for a May morning. Well, these don't fit with the title, Twelfth Night. We have been probably tempted to think of this play as transpiring during the Twelfth Night revelry period at one end of the year. And after all, it is titled Twelfth Night, and why would it be titled that if there weren't some reason for it? There is a story that it was actually played in court on Twelfth Night, but we have no proof of that. But at any rate, there is that association with one end of the year and a period of revelry at the year's end. preparatory to the new year and rebirth. But Midsummer Madness and the reference to May Day indicate quickly that there are festivities of a very similar sort of social chaos and overturn at the other end of the year, which are captured in a play like Midsummer Night's Dream. If this seems inconsistent, that's a rational way of looking at it. Another way of looking at it is it's yet another hint by Shakespeare that all binary opposites can easily turn into one another. They are in one way completely opposite, the opposite ends of the year, yet those two ends of the year have a very similar period of disorder leading to not only a return of order, but a possibility of renewal. In one way, this theme of carnival, the period of carnival, leads up to Lent and Easter, but you can take it as a conservative ploy on the part of the society to allow, as with the Roman festivity of Saturnalia, allow a certain letting off of steam by relaxing the social rules, letting people party, let them even satirize the authority figures. But then we return to work on Monday morning and it all just remains the same. It's really a reactionary device to keep the power structure in power. But there's always a hint that could be taken further that it isn't just a return, that something new might come out of it, some sort of renewal and therefore some sort of progress in a certain sense. And we will have to look at that carefully when we come to the end of the play. But at any rate, opposites are overturned. Opposites have a tendency to turn into each other. And at the two ends of the year, we have festivals of overturned chaos, at least feigned death or symbolic death, and possible renewal, that have a curious resemblance to each other, even though they're opposites. It all fits to the pattern of opposites that somehow belong together, what William Blake called contraries, and said, without contraries, no progression. At any rate, we don't have any renewed order here. We have madness. Why this is very Midsummer Madness? Well, whatever season it is, it looks like madness. And Olivia is concerned about him. She thinks he must have 104 fever and is delirious or something. And she says, where's my cousin Toby? Let some of my people have a special care of him. She means it solicitously, but as we will see soon, they're going to have a special care for him, okay? She is delivering him into the hands of the people who are going to torment him. And this will not go well for him. Fabian drops a remark of the sort that Shakespeare often will drop into a play, and more as he moves from the comedies to the romances. Fabian says, if this were played upon a stage now, I would condemn it as an improbable fiction. A little metafictional moment, as we say now, but pointing to a larger theme that is quite important in Shakespeare and not just a piece of wit, that theater is life and life is theater, that we are all acting roles and that the roles can be interchanged even into their opposites. Fabian is in on the con and he is conferring with the people who are going to torment Malvolio quite soon. And Fabian observes, why, we shall make him mad indeed. If he wasn't mad before, he will be by the time we get through with him. Well, that's not the only overturn and chaos in Act 3, Scene 4. We move to the other half of the plot that centers upon Viola, our heroine, but disguised as Cesario. This not very manly looking, for good reasons, young man. She is in disguise, and it has been useful to her in one way, in keeping her safe and also giving her employment with Duke Orsino, but she has landed herself inadvertently through the very nature of the disguise in a preposterous and uncomfortable situation where Orsino is clearly attracted to her, probably unconsciously, even though she is supposed to be a man, but he is responding to this rather feminine-looking young man in an increasingly affectionate way, though he claims to be fixated on Olivia. Meanwhile, Olivia, in the other household, has gone much further and has developed a mad infatuation with the same Cesario, thinking, again, that it's a male, not realizing she is infatuated with another woman. And Viola feels that she cannot break cover, if only out of loyalty to Duke Orsino, because she is endeavoring to fulfill her duty and her promise to woo Olivia for Orsino, out of partly obligation, but really unselfishness. That's going to be a differentiating factor. All these people who think they're wildly in love with somebody one moment and not the next. Viola is constant, and Viola is constant even though it costs her, and she will not get anything, or at least so far as she knows, she will lose from her loyalty, from her constancy. But she keeps it up, and that's going to be the moral axis of the play by the end. At any rate, Sir Andrew's crew is not done with tormenting Malvolio. They have somebody else to torment, and that is Sir Andrew Egucheek, who is here trying to woo Olivia, even though he's a complete doofus. He has no more business wooing Olivia than he does some Hollywood celebrity, but he's trying anyway, and he has money, which is why Sir Toby's putting up with him and using him very much as Iago uses Rodrigo, except very sinister there, but using him and at the same time making a fool out of him, and they're going to further that by fomenting a faux duel between Sir Andrew Egucheek, whom they know will be a complete coward when faced with actually trying to fight somebody else with a sword, despite all his professions, and this rather feminine-looking young man, Cesario, because they figure, well, Cesario is not going to be much of a fighter. You can just tell that by looking at him, and they are righter than they know. So Sir Toby puts Sir Andrew up to delivering the challenge of a duel to this Cesario guy on the grounds that it is a rival. Egucheek wants Olivia. Olivia is fixated on Cesario. You need to do something about this. So, challenge your rival to a duel. Look, he's a wimp. You can see by looking at him. You can beat him easy, no problem. So, send a letter. Do the right thing. Send a letter challenging him to a duel. Sir Andrew writes one, but Sir Toby says, in a soliloquy, well, I will not deliver this letter, for the young gentleman gives himself out to be of good capacity and breeding, and this letter written by Sir Andrew, being so excellently ignorant will breed no terror in the youth. He will find it comes from a clodpole. So the youth will not be shaken by this letter, obviously written by an idiot. So I will deliver the challenge orally, and I will build Sir Andrew up as this terrifying expert duelist who lives to fight. And he does so. And Viola says, I don't even know this man. This is uncivil as strange, I beseech you. What is going on here? And they claim, well, we don't know, but somehow you've managed to offend him. And he is indeed, Sir Fabian says, the most skillful, bloody, and fatal apposite you could possibly have found in any part of Illyria. And Viola is, of course, terrified. She's a brave woman, but she is a woman. She doesn't know how to use a sword. This is not, she is in one way very spunky and very courageous, but there's limits. This is not an era of kick-ass heroines yet. And she has no idea how to use a sword. And as she says to herself in an aside, pray God defend me. A little thing would make me tell them how much I lack of a man. And that is the Elizabethan joke about thing and no thing or nothing that we've seen in Hamlet that travels throughout many Shakespeare texts. Thing meaning male organ, and no thing representing the female lack. So that we have, you might say, a rather strange version of penis envy at the moment here. I lack. And it's not her fault. And nevertheless, they put both of them up to it. And you can imagine staging this, both of them probably looking a bit shaky. Sir Andrew is a coward. Viola has good reason to be afraid given what she's been told. And Sir Andrew has also been told that this Cesario turns out to be some sort of professional fencer. They say he's been fencer to the Sophie, to the one of the Eastern leaders. And Sir Andrew says, I'll not meddle with him. Oh, well, he will not now be pacified. Too late. So they're both totally shaking in their boots as they reluctantly draw, and it would be played on stage for hilarity. And then all of a sudden, the unexpected happens. Antonio, the friend of Viola's brother, Sebastian, whom we have met before, happens to be there and sees Cesario and thinks it's Sebastian, thinks that it is his friend Sebastian, because when Viola is made up as Cesario, they are identical twins and you can't tell them apart. Doubtful if that would be plausible in real life, but we go with it. In the comedy, that's the rule. You can't tell them apart. They might as well be clones. Antonio thinks that he sees his friend Sebastian being threatened, and out of loyalty, unselfish loyalty, there's that theme again, despite the fact that this is very bad for him because he's a wanted man in Illyria. He's gone afoul of Duke Orsino, who rules it sometime in the past. It is not good for him to break his cover, but for the sake of his friend, he steps in and says to Sir Andrew, put up your sword. If this young gentleman hath done offense, I take the fault on me. And Sir Toby says, you, sir, why, what are you? And sure enough, one thing you can say about Illyria is that this is one country where if you want a cop, he's immediately there, apparently. enter officers immediately. No indication of how they knew and how they got there so quickly, but here they are. And not only that, but they're good at their job, recognize that this is a wanted man. Antonio, I arrest thee at the suit of Count Orsino. Well, they're only doing their job as they see it. And Antonio turns to Viola, in other words, to Cesario, in other words, to the person he thinks is his friend Sebastian, and says, I have to ask you now for my purse. I gave you my purse full of money, but now I'm afraid I need it now that I've been arrested. And Viola says, what money, sir? And she says, for the kindness you've shown me, I only have a little money and I will give you half of it because you've stepped in kindly for me here, but I really, that's all I have. I'm sorry, and I don't really know you. Antonio is not only outraged, but he's cut to the quick, because what he saw as a loyal friendship, he sees as being selfishly betrayed. And he is absolutely, bitterly angry and disillusioned, and is taken away. But he has mentioned the name Sebastian. And at the end of scene four, which is also the end of act three, Viola says to herself, he named Sebastian. And, oh, if it prove, tempests are kind and salt waves fresh in love. That would be a miracle, and yet he mentioned Sebastian. Well, that is one part of the plot. But we have another part of the plot that plays itself out as we move over into Act Four. Returning, Shakespeare always keeps jumping back and forth between the various plots and subplots and factions of characters. And we return to, okay, Malvolio has now been taken away by Sir Toby's crowd, and they are joined by Fest the clown, who takes the lead in the, symbolically speaking, the baiting of Malvolio. The opening scene of Act Four is Sebastian meeting up with Fest the clown, and more confusion of identity, because Fest himself, who is a shrewd character, but even he cannot tell Sebastian from Cesario, and he takes Sebastian to be Cesario, and Sebastian says, go to, thou art a foolish fellow. You know, I don't know you. And Fest thinks, okay, you're trying to outdo me at my own clowning, jesting game. Well, held out in faith. Oh, no, I do not know you, nor I am not sent to you by my lady to bid you to come speak with her, nor your name is not Master Cesario, and this is not my nose neither. Nothing that is so is so. It's an exasperated, though witty speech, but in fact, it is not Cesario, and nothing that is so is so could not only be a motto for the entirety of Twelfth Night, but really represents an important subtext in all of Shakespeare's comedies and romances. There is a surface plot that concerns two things: social conflicts and interactions on the one hand, and individual psychology on the other, both of which fall into the area of, you might say, relative realism. There's plenty of absurdity that goes on in the conflicts, and yet, you know, this is the real world and its conflicts as we know it. Shakespeare, and this is not true of all comedy, but it is true even in some of Shakespeare's lighter simpler, earlier comedies, there's just about always a subtext lurking of the questioning of the real. All this stuff goes on the surface, conflicts and ups and downs and backs and forth. But eventually, there's a questioning of what is real and what is not, especially when we get the period where all hell breaks loose. It's not always identified with festivals like Carnival or Saturnalia, but there's always a period of chaotic. The social order is turned topsy-turvy, upside down. And in those moments, reality gets doubted. We see it in the tragedies also. I've said that Twelfth Night is next door in time, within a year of Hamlet, and this theme of the questioning of what is real and what is not, and the theme of madness. If I don't know what's real and what is not, then I am on the brink of madness. Maybe I'm over the brink of madness. And in the tormenting of Malvolio in a dark room, making him doubt his sanity, though he declares that, no, I am sane, and they say, no, you're not. We reach one of those moments where a festive comedy looks into a dark place that lies under everybody's feet. And for a moment, there are vertiginous implications. We'll see how that plays out next week.